last time we sort of touched on the idea of detachment when we were talking about, in a sense, letting ourselves off the hook, this idea of regrets and dealing with regrets, and how does one handle bad things that one's done in one's life. And Montaigne's attitude toward it was simple. You strive to be the best person you can be, and when you mess up, you don't worry about it. Why? Because what's done is done, and it can't be changed by moping or persecuting yourself. The only thing that's changed when you do that is your happiness in the here and now. You are plunged into a depressed and gloomy state of mind, and that's not a good thing to do. So the pursuit of happiness requires that we be willing, in a sense, to get over, distance ourselves, disown our things that we regret, and not worry about them too much, not wring our hands over them. In short, it requires a capacity to detach ourselves from things, to disown certain things, and to not worry about certain things. And this notion of detachment really has been treated as the key to happiness. And there are two schools of thought that we're going to look at that both preach detachment. One is Stoicism, and the other is Buddhism. The Stoics were one of the ancient Greek schools of thought that came into existence near the end of the life of Plato, after the death of Socrates. The founder of Stoicism was a fellow named Zeno of Citium. And Zeno was apparently Phoenician, but he was thoroughly Hellenistic in his orientation and upbringing. He was a Greek speaker. He traveled to Athens when he was young and studied philosophy. And he was especially taken with the life and example of Socrates. However, he was less taken with Plato's dialogues about Socrates than with Xenophon's Socratic writings. And Xenophon has an interesting work called Memorabilia, Memoirs of Socrates, which recounts a number of conversations. And one of the conversations there is Socrates arguing that everything in the world is ordered by mind, by some kind of divine intelligence, towards the good. And this view was taken up by Zeno and turned into an extraordinary argument. Zeno believe that everything in the world happens for the good. Now, this seems to be difficult to swallow, given all the bad things that have happened. Is all that hog waste in North Carolina swirling around in the rivers for the good? You could raise, or, you know, for that matter, was World War II a good thing? There's a lot of bad stuff going on in the world, and the Stoics didn't deny that there were bad things. But they did argue that the universe was constructed in such a way that all the bad things were, in a sense, necessary components for the production of a whole that was taken as a whole good. So the cosmos as a whole is good, and all the bad things in the cosmos are necessarily there, but they're more than recompensed by the overall goodness of things. Now, another thing that Zeno took from Socrates was the claim that there's something invulnerable about human happiness or human virtue properly understood. Socrates claimed near the end of his life in his defense speech, basically, that you can kill me, but you can't make me a bad man. And he identified happiness or well-being with virtue. And his claim was that his enemies were about to put him to death, but that only made them bad men, made them less just by doing acts of injustice. It corrupted their souls, whereas Socrates was getting off with the better end of the bargain, because although he was being killed, he wasn't being corrupted. He wasn't going to become a bad man. And the assumption here is that virtue or happiness or well-being is something that is a possession of the soul, it's a characteristic of the soul, and no external events can take that away without your cooperation. Nobody can corrupt you unless you cooperate with it. And so even though people can make you miserable or dead, they can't make you into a bad person. And since happiness really consists of being in a state of virtue or being good, happiness is invulnerable to fortune, to circumstance. It can't be taken away from you. your life could be taken away, but not your happiness. And of the two, Socrates thought that one's happiness was more important than one's life, in the sense that there were certain conditions under which he would refuse to live, and one of those conditions would be to live as a bad man. Life wouldn't be worth living that way. And this is the meaning of his famous claim, the unexamined life isn't worth living. The examined life is the philosophical life, which is a pursuit of virtue, which is a pursuit of well-being, whereas the unexamined life is the unphilosophic life. And that life is marked by a lack of goodness, a lack of health in the soul, and therefore a lack of what makes life really worthwhile. So Zeno took up these two claims. One, that everything in the cosmos is not necessarily good, but that everything in the cosmos is somehow ordered in such a way that the whole of things, viewed as a whole, is good. And that happiness is an internal possession of the soul, and that it's invulnerable to circumstance, to external circumstances, to fortune. Zeno took from the notion that the universe is governed in such a way that the whole is good, he took from that the notion that there is what we call a divine providence, which he identified also with destiny or fate. And he did believe that most external things are determined by the decrees of fate. However, there are some things that are under our control, and those are all the things that are inside us, our moods, our feelings, our judgments. The inner life is within our control. Basically, the teaching of the Stoics was therefore this. You can't do anything about fate. It'll hand you good things or bad things. And if you depend on fate to make you happy, you're likely going to be unhappy. Why? Because you're investing your happiness in things that aren't really yours. And any external thing isn't really yours. You may say that you have a car, but it can be taken away from you. It's being towed right now, or being stolen right now. You might have a wife or a husband or a child, but those can be taken away from you. You can lose those things. You can lose the shirt off your back, so it's not really yours. All the things that can be taken away from you are not really things that you have to begin with. What are the only things that can't be taken away from you? What are the only things you really can control? Again, it's your inner life. It's your decisions, your moods, your judgments. That is within your control. And therefore, if we're going to pursue happiness, we're going to have to pursue it by taking care of the things that we really can control. That's the most reliable path to happiness. The most reliable path to happiness is the care of the soul. Because investment of the self in external things really gives hostages to fortune. And the more hostages you give to fortune, the more likely that your life can be overturned by a simple run of bad luck. So, the Stoics were ascetic to some extent in their overall orientation. Now, that didn't prevent one great Roman Stoic from being emperor, namely Marcus Aurelius, and in a sense owning the whole world, anything he wanted, in the civilized world at least. And another of the great Roman Stoics was Seneca, who was the richest man in Rome. However, he didn't give it all away near the end of his life. He tried to buy his freedom. He wanted to retire from public life, and he gave his fortune to Nero. He tried to buy the little son of a bitch off, but it didn't work. Nero forced Seneca to commit suicide, and Seneca committed suicide and arranged everything in such a way that he gave a speech that reminded everybody present of Socrates' death. And they thought, you know, he's a dramatist, he wrote plays, he was grandstanding to the very end. The fact is that being very rich is consistent with being a Stoic, at least for the Romans, in the sense that one can accept all the gifts of fortune. But if one invests oneself too deeply in these things and can't lose them without losing oneself, then one has made a very bad investment. The more we invest ourselves in external things, the more easily just bad luck can destroy us or make us miserable. And Seneca was an example of a person who was fairly happy and was clearly detached, though, from the immense fortune that he had created, primarily through real estate speculating and money lending at incredibly usurious interest rates. He was a hard-nosed businessman. But he was detached enough that he could contemplate giving it all up when he had to in order to attain his freedom, which was the thing that was really the most important. And he didn't seem to lament his lost possessions. The only thing he lamented is that they weren't sufficient to buy his freedom. Well, the first Stoic school were the ancient Greek Stoics. And we only possess fragments of the Greek Stoics' works, which is astonishing because Zeno wrote 100 books and Chrysippus and Cleanthes wrote enormous numbers of works. Nothing has survived complete except for a single poem by Cleanthes called The Hymn to Zeus. Everything else has been lost. It's rather extraordinary how much has been lost. Fortunately for us, though, the later Stoic schools were primarily centered in Rome, and the three great Stoic thinkers of the Roman era were Seneca, Epictetus, and Marcus Aurelius, and we have virtually everything these men wrote. Epictetus was born Greek, and he was a slave in Rome. He was apparently crippled by abuse, but eventually he gained his freedom and became the teacher of the emperor Marcus Aurelius. It's emblematic of the nature of Stoicism that a lowly slave or the emperor of the known world could both subscribe to it, and neither one were particularly dissatisfied with their lots in life. And neither one of them felt particularly the need to abolish institutions like slavery and things like that. The Stoics taught that all human beings, insofar as they possessed reason, had a certain intrinsic worth and dignity, which is the basis for a notion of natural rights and things like that. The Stoics were enormously influential in the origin of Western jurisprudence. Yet they were remarkably complacent about the social order of their time. They didn't see any inconsistency with claiming that human dignity was widespread, that every human being had a certain worth or dignity, and some were slaves and others were masters. And the reason why they didn't is that they fundamentally didn't think that any external conditions mattered that much for human happiness. And this is something that we have to treat very seriously. It's an extraordinary claim. They actually made the claim that the sage, the truly wise human being, the true practicing Stoic, was not in any way different from the gods. They were mortal, and the gods were immortal, but as far as the quality of their lives were concerned, they didn't have a happiness that was inferior to that of the gods. These guys made extraordinary claims, and they were very serious about it, and the Stoic school survived for a very long period of time. Eventually, when paganism in the Roman world disappeared, it disappeared along with it. But many of the ideas of the Roman Stoics, especially Seneca, were enormously appealing to early Christian writers, and so virtually all of their works survived just because they were deemed worthy of having copies made of them. And that's how they've come down to the modern world. The Christians like the Stoics. Stoa is Greek for porch. Zeno began his school at one of the public stoas in Athens. And it doesn't mean just the porch on a house. It was a very impressive public building that consisted of a long colonnade in front, and then behind it there were rooms that were sort of open to the air, and public business and things like that were conducted at the stoas, and apparently informal gatherings by people like Zeno and his students also went on at the stoas, and so it came to be called the Stoic School of Philosophy. Aristotle was known as someone who walked around with his students, lecturing to them, and so his school became known as the Peripatetic School, which means just the people who walk around. The Cynic School derives its name from the Greek word for dog, because Diogenes and the other Cynics were regarded as low dog-like kinds of people. It was a term of abuse, but to demonstrate their lack of conventionality, they immediately embraced it. What I want to do is I want to just sort of flip through the reading and pick out certain passages, and we'll just discuss whether or not they make any sense, and whether or not the Stoic route is the route to happiness. And again, very simply, the idea is this. There are things we can control and things we can't control. We should only seek happiness in the realm of the things we can control. The things we can control are the inner things, and therefore we should focus most of our energies on the inner life and the inner man, and divest ourselves of too much concern with external things. And if fortune has given us lots of external things, well, we don't necessarily have to get rid of them all, but we have to be able to lose them without losing ourselves. My father is or was a Stoic in some ways, although he didn't know it. He was always loath to spend any amount of money on things like pens or cameras, because he would always lose them. He said, I just couldn't bear losing an expensive camera, so he would buy cheap cameras, and he would promptly lose them. It was astonishing the number of cameras he lost in his lifetime. Only near the end of his life did he finally go in for something, because he felt, well, I can afford to lose this. You know, I won't feel too bad about it. Yeah, the camera's still here, but he isn't, alas. It outlasted him. Let's look at the first little passage here, and this will get us started. Epictetus says, some things are up to us and some things are not. This is the beginning. We can all agree with this, can't we? Our opinions are up to us and our impulses, desires, aversions, in short, whatever is our own doing. Our bodies are not up to us. Now, some of us find that comforting, others find that appalling, I suppose. But what he's saying is simply, look, you know, you get a body. You have a certain genetic capabilities. You can take better or worse care of it, but it's still the body that was given to you. And you can't have another one. Okay, that's all he's saying. They're not up to us, nor are our possessions, our reputations, our public offices, or that is, whatever is not our own doing. The things that are up to us are by nature free, unhindered and unimpeded. The things that are not up to us are weak, enslaved, hindered, not our own. So remember, if you think that things naturally enslaved are free, or that things not your own are your own, you will be thwarted, miserable, and upset, and will blame both gods and men. But of course, the only person you have to blame is yourself, because you misunderstood the true nature of things. If you look across onto page 55, he talks about detachment here, fourth line down. It says, so detach your aversion from everything not up to us, and transfer it to what is against nature among the things that are up to us. Don't hate things you can't change. Only hate the things you can change. And for the time being, eliminate desire completely. Since if you desire something that is not up to us, you are bound to be unfortunate. And at the same time, none of the things that are up to us, which it would be good to desire, will be available to you. Now this brings us to another feature of the Stoics. The Stoics are known as enemies of feeling and desire. And it certainly sounds like that here. He says, eliminate desire completely, for the time being, though. And what does this mean? Well, it means this. We live in a very sensitive age. And nothing can be more calculated to offend than the idea that feelings are bad. And that we should want to feel less. The Greek word for feeling literally means something that we suffer. I mean, the word passion literally means something that you suffer, something you undergo. People who are very passionate are people who are constantly being jerked around by external circumstances. They're constantly being pulled this way and that way. They get a passion for this, and they are rushing off for it, and then they get a passion for something else, and they're rushing off for it. We have to understand that feelings are things that we undergo, things that we, in a sense, suffer, and things that we seldom have any control over. And insofar as we don't control them, it's not a very good thing to put your happiness entirely in the realm of feeling, or make your happiness depend on feelings. Why? Because you can't control them, especially if they're feelings for external things or other people. Now, that doesn't mean that we should no longer have an emotional life. But what it does mean, though, is that our emotional lives should not have us. Okay, if that distinction makes sense. Again, the Stoics are not saying don't have an emotional life. They're saying don't let your emotional life have you. And this is why he can only recommend really trying to put aside desires temporarily. Why? For the simple reason that when you're starting out, and this is a manual for beginners, this book, the Handbook, is just a sort of beginner's Stoic manual. You know, the big golden book of Stoicism. Okay. When you're starting out, you have to cleave to extremes in order to get to a happy medium. And the person who starts out studying Stoicism is a normal, ordinary person who's pretty much a puppet and slave of their own desires. And therefore, you have to cleave towards a state of desirelessness in order to learn how to discipline your feelings. But the ideal state really is a state where one enjoys all the pleasures of life, and that means one has an active emotional life, but one's in control of it, and it's not in control of you. That's his attitude. And the philosopher who in modernity put it best was Spinoza. He said that the passions are a source of human bondage. The book of his Ethics on the Passions is called Of Human Bondage, from which we get the Somerset Maugham title, for one thing, which is a nice story about being a slave to passion. But the goal of the pursuit of happiness, if you will, is to replace passions with active feelings. And what does that mean? What does it mean to replace feelings you suffer with feelings that are active? Well, ultimately what it means is that these are feelings behind which you, as an agent, stand and are in control. And the question would be, well, how does one attain control of one's feelings? Well, they try and give certain exercises, certain imaginative kinds of exercises you can do in order to attain control of your feelings. The Stoics are arguing the best life is a life where your happiness depends on the things you can control. Now, passions, as such, are things that you undergo. They're not things you can control. However, you still have feelings, even if you don't have passions. There's a distinction here, I guess, that we have to grasp between feelings and passions. And this is why Spinoza's helpful, because he distinguishes between active and passive feelings. Passive feelings are things that you just undergo. They just happen upon you. Whereas active feelings are feelings behind which you stand as an agent and are in control. So you have the feelings don't have you. That's the sense. The Stoics are misrepresented as people who simply want to extinguish the emotional life altogether. They recognize that's not possible. And they're not the kinds of people who try and do things that aren't possible. That's the whole philosophy, right? The point is to do what is possible, and that is to try and replace simply passive feelings with more active feelings, to take control of one's emotional life. And how does one do that? Well, they do try and prescribe certain thought experiments and things to tell yourself when you feel almost at the brink of being carried away. Every feeling can be active or passive, depending on how you appropriate it, in a sense, or don't. Exactly. So you can have active or passive love or anger or fear, things like that. And what is it to have active feelings in this sense, or to be in control of them? Well, they try and give certain little thought experiments that you can do, certain little maxims and rules you can tell yourself, little reminders, you know, daily affirmations almost, that you should remind yourself of whenever you're about to be carried away with feelings. So he says, for instance, well, let's just go seriatim through the text and we'll point these things out. They do set goals, but they recognize that happiness depends upon achieving goals, too. But it's only those goals that are attainable, and they had a fairly low opinion about what's really attainable by human beings. And the Stoics were very pessimistic by modern standards about the ability of human beings to control their lives, control their environments, to change things. The order of things that they saw around them, they thought was immutable. In some sense, even though we know that, and even though they knew that history had happened and that things weren't always the way they were, they still had a sense that, look, you know, there's a certain fate that we're given. We're just thrown into the world that we're in. It's foolish to think we can change it. It's too big. It's got a logic of its own. The only thing that we can do is try and change ourselves to fit it. And so one of the wonderful metaphors that the Stoics have is it's based on the Roman victory parades. There are two kinds of people when it comes to fate, right? Fate is like the victorious general. Okay, there are two groups. One is the group that rides along in the chariot, and the other is dragged along as slaves and captives behind it. But you make the same trip, right? You make the same trip whether you go kicking and screaming or whether you just get on board and go with it. And this is our only choice when it comes to fate. We're given a body. We're thrown into a world, into a particular historical epoch. There's a singer, Thomas Questoff. He's a operatic baritone. There was a thing about him recently on 60 Minutes. He's some sort of dwarf, or perhaps some sort of thalidomide case. I don't know which, but his limbs are very, very tiny and withered, and he can't really do much with them. He has a magnificent voice, and he's really made a lot out of a life that none of us would really want to have. I mean, you know, he's this misshapen sort of just torso of a man, basically. And at the end of this interview, the interviewer said, if you could give up your singing and your voice in order to just be a normal person, what would you be? And he said, I stay as I am. Why? Well, because he was fated in a certain condition, right? That's just given to him. And he's made the best of it. Instead of moping around like many people would do in a situation like that, he's actually become a rather successful and remarkable person. The point is that his only choice was to be himself. He could be himself kicking, screaming, fighting against it, and therefore miserable, or he could just accept his lot and try and make something out of it. Either way, you make that same trip. It's just a matter of doing it willingly or unwillingly. The Stoics really say, look, detach yourself from anything that's out of your control. If you're angry about something that you can't change and could never have changed, that's silly. You're wasting your energy. You're not changing the fact that makes you angry. You're just changing yourself from being a person who could be happy and at peace into a person who's angry and at war. Right? That's what you can do. So detach yourselves from the things that you can't control and attach yourself to the things that you can. When you put it in the simplest terms, it's kind of hard to gainsay, right? However, there are lots of people who don't live their lives that way. And there are people who, well, if you look at modernity, the whole modern world is about taking control of our fate. The whole project of, you know, science and technology and progress haven't always been around. They were started. All of these things were started by, modernity is about mankind's project of self-emancipation, of taking greater control over our fate. And I know people who find the idea of dying, well, no one likes it, I suppose, but there are people who simply deny that it's necessarily going to happen. Why? Well, because we're on the brink of breakthroughs in science that are going to prolong life indefinitely. There are people out there who say this stuff, and they believe this. Well, they're scientists, exactly. There are people who think that man will make himself immortal, that we won't have to deal with fate. I think that it's not going to happen all at once. They're realistic about it, and there's always going to be problems that we're going to face. But they project a kind of endless process of greater and greater human mastery over our circumstances. And in a sense, that's a very un-Stoic way of looking at things. The idea of progress is very un-Stoic. The Stoics didn't believe in it. Thought, we can't control this. And early modern philosophers said, oh, yes, we can. And that's what man is trying to do. And so some people would say, look, don't give in. You don't like your chin? Get it fixed. If it were simply possible to go and press a button and get your limbs back or something, of course no one would have to adjust to this. But the thing is that people are in sort of a strange limbo. They're always hoping. people who are very sick, who are terminally ill. They carry on because they're hoping that something will happen, there'll be a miracle, they'll get better, and oftentimes they don't accept the circumstances, and so actually what happens is they have very limited amount of life left to them, and they waste it by worrying and fretting and rebelling against the inevitable and instead of simply accepting it. So there's this kind of nether region, this region of hope that we all have, this sort of hope that around the corner there's going to be a breakthrough. And this is where a lot of people live. And it allows us to temporize and not make decisions about things or accept certain things. We're always hoping that maybe next year it'll be different. We've done a great job of curing things that were accepted as inevitable. This is the difficulty with Stoicism, and Zeno caught one of his slaves stealing from him, and the little fellow cheekily said, "Look, I was fated to do this." And he said, I'm fated to beat you," he said. So point is that the idea that there's fate doesn't mean fatalism, right? In this sense, you know, there are people in 18th, 17th century British or Western philosophers, when they talk about freedom, they always talk about Muslim fatalism. And whether this is true or not, I don't know. But the point is that this was sort of one of the foils that they would always have. You're crossing a river in a boat, and the boat turns over, and they think, "Well, it's my time." And they don't bother trying to swim. Well, if people were like that, that would be rather bad. The Roman Stoics and the Greek Stoics didn't have that kind of attitude. The attitude is that you can't know what fate decrees until you strive in certain situations, right? The point is that fate works through you as an agent as well as stomps down on you as a patient, right? This actually, interestingly enough, sort of lines up with the Nietzsche distinction that we talked about last time between the active and the passive nihilist. You can have a kind of active and passive fatalist, too. Napoleon is a marvelous example of a human being who believed in fate, but wasn't sitting around waiting for it to make things happen. He believed that he had a destiny to fulfill through his actions, and he was totally convinced of this, and he also was convinced that as soon as he had fulfilled it, that it would simply cast him aside or he could be knocked over with a feather. But until then, he believed he was unstoppable. That sense that he had a fate or a destiny and that it was working through him as an agent encouraged him to be an enormously active person who did really change the course of history. Now, passive fatalism is the attitude of the person who, when the boat tips over, thinks, "Well, I guess I'm fated to drown," because their assumption is they're just patients, right? They're just sufferers, not actors, and that fate doesn't somehow work through them. It just works on them. The Romans tended to think that fate works through you as well as on you, and therefore they didn't counsel total passivity or resignation. What they counseled is this. They counseled a life of duty, which is an active life of doing the right thing. Let's say that you go forward actively in life. You're given a position in life. You're given a role. You're emperor or you're a slave. Whatever. You've got a duty. You've got a job to do. And the argument was you find your station in life and you do your duty and you do it actively. And then when you look back on the things that have happened, the things that can't be changed, that's what you resign yourself to. But there's no sense that human beings are merely putty that fate works on and not agents that fate works through. They have no sense of that kind of fatalism. So the assumption is this. Again, you're given tasks to perform. Human beings are actors. We're not stones. And to own up to the fate of a human being is to own up to the necessity of acting. You have different jobs to do, given whatever fate has dealt you, but you're supposed to try and do it as well as possible. And whatever the outcome, you accept as an unalterable decree of fortune. And when it comes to dealing with death, I mean, frankly, Stoicism is our only choice, unless you believe that right around the corner somebody's going to invent something that will make us immortal. Years ago, this fellow contacted me because of something that I wrote. And for ages, he was just this pesky little unreciprocated pen pal. You know, I get letters. I was too busy to respond, you know. And finally, he found my email address, and then it's all started up again. And I just think, the uninvited pen pal. But anyway, it turns out that he believes that human immortality is just around the corner. And I wrote back to him, and I said, look, what you're talking about is an indefinitely elongated lifespan, and that's different from immortality. Because when you're 800 or 1,000 years old, you could still trip over your rug, bust open your skull and bleed to death, and that's the end of you. And if you think that you're not going to have to come to grips with mortality because science is going to make some breakthroughs in the near future, you're just fooling yourself. I haven't heard from him since then. But when it comes to death or aging, look, you're going to do it. The only choice you've got is to do it kicking or screaming or with a little bit of dignity. Kicking and screaming means, you know, in my view, our culturally unhealthy obsession with youth. There was a lady I knew who, I could tell she believed this long before she actually said it, because she just always seemed tense and seething and just on the edge of exploding. We were talking about stoicism, and she said, I'm sorry, but I think resentment is just great. And she just said it this way, I think resentment is just great. And you could see that all of these things that she was angry about were flooding back into her mind as she was saying this. Only by resenting things that you make any changes in the world and get things done. And I said, I beg to differ, you know. I beg to differ. It's not cathartic. It's a kind of poison. Because resentment is always backwards looking. And Nietzsche talks about the will's resentment against time. It's sort of his version of what Freud would call neurosis, or the death instinct. The will's resentment against time is the inability for you to detach yourself from bad things that have happened and can't be undone. So you had a rotten upbringing. Well, I'm sorry, get over it, because you don't have any other choice. I mean, Dr. Laura's right with her get over it message, because everything that's happened in the past has to be simply gotten over. You can't change it. So resentment, if it's directed towards the past, is just sort of a poison. It's a kind of auto-intoxication. You poison yourself by hating things and resenting things that can't be undone. However, these kinds of feelings can be active. You can have active resentment in the sense that you're not resenting things in the past, but you're sort of pushing forwards towards things in the future and trying to change things. It's perfectly reasonable on a stoic model of things for you to have made a mistake and you have certain feelings towards that error. Okay, now they'd say, don't resent the past mistake. Don't persecute yourself for it. Take those feelings and channel them towards not making the same mistake again. That makes it future-oriented. And it actually is, in a sense, healthy and cathartic. One of the things that's so unhealthy and untherapeutic about most modern psychotherapies is they are so past-oriented, so resentment-oriented, in a sense, whereas you can only live in the future. And it's all well and good to understand your past. You have to do that. But to dwell upon it once you understand it sufficiently, to dwell upon it is terribly unhealthy, and then you have to reorient yourself towards the future and learn whatever lessons you've learned and apply those things forward. Kierkegaard has this wonderful line where he talks about how, you know, the sad thing is that we live forwards and understand backwards. That means we're always making mistakes, and we've got tons of mistakes that we've accumulated over our lives. That means we're going forward blindly. We only understand retrospectively. The key to life is to constantly live forwards. If you want to do it better, deploy everything that you've understood by looking back. I just love the opening of the handbook. Some things are up to us and some things are not up to us. What could be more simple? There's this prayer that Reinhold Niebuhr is credited with about, I forget how it goes, the Alcoholics Anonymous people use this. Serenity towards the things you can't change, the ability to change the things you can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Well, that's pure stoicism. acceptance of the things you can't change, you know, courage, and they were big on virtues, old-fashioned virtues like courage and fortitude, stiff upper lip kind of stuff. When you talk about Stoicism, that refers to a lot of old-fashioned manly virtues like courage and fortitude and willingness to bear up under suffering and so forth. One index of the transformation of our political culture, I think, is to compare Jacqueline Kennedy's demeanor after her husband's death and how people praised her stoicism and fortitude and dignity versus the reactions of people after Princess Diana's death, when the only thing they wanted to do was to see the queen cry. They thought that all this stoicism and dignity and fortitude that was coming out of Buckingham Palace was immoral and wicked, or they wanted to see some signs of mourning. That really is a nice indication of a kind of overall transformation of what is regarded in this culture as moral behavior. So as one person put it, we've moved from the stiff upper lip to the quivering lower lip kind of culture. Page 63. Appropriate actions are in general measured by relationships. He is a father. That entails taking care of him, yielding to him in everything, putting up with him when he abuses you or strikes you. But he is a bad father. Does nature then determine that you have a good father? No, only that you have a father. My brother has done me wrong. This is sort of like a dialogue where you don't know exactly who's saying what. You know, it's sort of a back and forth kind of thing. My brother has done me wrong. Then keep your place in relation to him. Do not consider his action, but instead consider what you can do to bring your own faculty of choice into accord with nature. Another person will not do you harm unless you wish it. You will be harmed at just that time at which you take yourself to be harmed. In this way, then, you will discover the appropriate actions to expect from a neighbor, from a citizen, from a general, if you're in the habit of looking at relationships. This is kind of obscure, I have to say, but this makes it very clear, though, that they had a sense that whatever lot in life you find yourself in, it has certain appropriate actions and reactions to it. So if you find yourself being a father, that means you have responsibilities to your children, things like that. And they have to be pious and respectful and yield to you in everything. But then the question is how do you deal with the fact that people have done bad job at being your parent? He says, look, you know, nature gave you a father, didn't necessarily give you a good one. Again, don't resent the fact that you cannot change, but simply try and make the best of what you can do. I think that's what he means by adjusting your desire, or is it judgment, into accordance with nature. That means, in a sense, diminish your expectations. It is a counsel of resignation, but again, it's a counsel of resignation to things that have already happened. And you can't help but resign yourself to those. It doesn't do any good to cry over spilled milk. You know, another Stoic maxim. It's very passive with regard to things that have already happened and can't be undone. There's certain pessimism there. Well, there's a lot of truth to that, though, too. I mean, how many people have wasted time in bad relationships because they think, if I'm just loving enough, I can change this person and make them better. If I just give them enough love and patience and kindness, they'll become a better spouse or whatever. It doesn't necessarily work. But there is some possibility of moral suasion. Well, it does seem to be leaving out moral suasion. Exactly. Maybe you're the kind of person fated to go around and tell people off and say, look, you can be better. You can be better. I'm not going to accept it. And look, you know, there's a real use not only for high expectations that are reasonable, but even unreasonably high expectations. There's a tendency for people to live up or down to the expectations you have of them. This is what's so naive about cynicism. A person who's cynical about people thinks, well, they're just being realistic, but really their cynicism isn't just realism, it's an actually corruptive force. Because if you deal with somebody who's cynical, you tend to live down to their expectations. Life is short, resources are scarce, and if somebody expects very little from you, well, my tendency is to give them very little. There's some truth to that doesn't seem to be captured here. Number 29 is kind of long, but it's a great passage. What he's talking about there is worldly ambitions. And he's saying, look, if you want to be an Olympic victor, don't just wish it. know what you want, know what you have to do, and realize that it's going to be difficult. Realize that you can't be it and something else at the same time. It's incompatible. Be highly realistic and accept exactly the difficulties of life. But that doesn't mean that anything that you're to be passive. It means that in being active, you have to reconcile yourself to the necessities of existence and get along with those things and work within those. And he does talk about you have to accept yourself and understand your own nature. He's saying, do you want to be a wrestler? This is about 10 lines from the bottom. Look at your arms, your thighs, inspect your loins. Different people are naturally suited for different things. Get your ambitions in line with your abilities. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't have ambitions. So here's the active side of it. The other side is fairly fatalistic on the level of personal, interpersonal relationships. But this is about being yourself, right, which is more in your control. And maybe the Stoics are a little too lax, or a little too pessimistic about the possibility of changing others for the future, for the better. But of course you can't change others in the sense that you can't undo the bad things that have already been done. You must be one person, either good or bad. You must either work on your ruling principle or work on externals. Practice the art either of what is inside or what is outside. That is, play the role either of a philosopher or a non-philosopher. So you want to know the distinction? I mean, the philosopher is the person who works on the inside, not the outside, who works on the ruling principle, and that means their soul. That's the ruling and animating principle. And the part of the soul that rules is our rational faculty. So we perfect and cultivate our reason. The initial line, you must be one person, either good or bad. I think what he's basically saying is look, you can't be everything. You have to accept the limitations of life. And you can't do all the things. Good or bad, you've got to be one. And therefore, don't think you can be many. Don't be the dilettante. Marx has this image of life after history, where you hunt in the morning and rear cattle in the afternoon and write literary criticism after supper. So there's got to be a unity to a good life. You can't be everything, I think, is the assumption here. I think there's some truth to that. There has to be some unifying principle to a good life. You can't just be scattered all over the place.